We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, it is Tuesday, January 28th, and everything else seems to be going well. We're still having some a little bit of technical difficulty, so I'm joining you by our web application. If you think that I sound a little bit different, that is not you. It is fully us. You know, it's not you, it's me, you know, in our radio relationship, but that's actually true this morning. So apologies for that. We are getting that sorted out as soon as possible. But, you know, let's get to the headlines. The first one that I got to just say, you know, is so fascinating to me. We finally have a lot of movement in the federal government, and the federal government is operating and firing on all cylinders. I mean, we're seeing how now the federal government is where woke goes to die, which is absolutely amazing. We're going to talk about that more later on in the program. And Trump is signing executive orders. He is confirming, you know, his nominees are getting confirmed through the Senate. He's doing all kinds of things, and he's doing things so fast that the media just can't keep up with all of the stories, which I love, because then they can't just myopically focus on one thing and call him names. It's like they just don't know where to look because there are so many different squirrels running around DC, and I love it. So the federal government is finally getting under control and hopefully, you know, rolling back a lot of these utterly preposterous Biden era executive orders and policies and so forth. And now Florida, which is the state that was firing on all cylinders, and you know, the eternal example of, you know, everything of the Republican supermajority, great governor, you know, our legislature, everything was great. Now suddenly in this special session, I don't even know what's happening, but the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate are bucking Governor DeSantis's leadership, which is to implement Trump's policies, which they all agree on. So it makes absolutely no sense for the Republican supermajority, who has a great leader in Governor DeSantis, to try to go to war with him over absolutely nothing. And so it's a watered down proposal. And what happened yesterday is the gaveling in of the special session, which the House Speaker and the President of the Senate in Florida objected to, and they didn't want to do it, and they were whining and complaining. So Governor DeSantis called it anyway and was like, too bad, go to Tallahassee, get to work. And so they gaveled in the special session yesterday and then immediately gaveled out and then called their own special session, which previously they had both said a special session is premature, but I guess under their own rules, then they think that it's fine. And so it's like, you know, no, I'm going to take my toys and go home. I mean, they're petulant children at this point that are leading both houses in Florida, and it's ridiculous. So they now have this proposal, because the whole point of this was supposed to be on immigration and ensuring that Florida would take President Trump's leadership and the mandate for America and, you know, start actually doing a lot of these deportations, securing the border, all of these things, even more than, you know, what Governor DeSantis has been able to do over the last 4 years of Biden's presidency. And there is an absolutely watered down proposal and response. And so Governor DeSantis, and you can go and listen to his commentary on this, by the way, and I'd encourage all of you to follow him on both of his socials, at Gov Ron DeSantis and also just at Ron DeSantis, because he posts different things. You know, one is obviously more political. One's the official governor page, you know, kind of how Trump has POTUS, but he also has real Donald Trump. So go follow both of them and see his commentary. But he also posted this side-by-side, Governor Ron DeSantis' proposals and the Florida legislature's watered-down response. And all of these things, you can see what the governor's session proposals were for law enforcement compliance, criminal penalties for illegal entry, state immigration enforcement officer, unauthorized alien transport program, gang enforcement, educational and voting reforms, remittance and financial oversight, bail and flight risk presumptions. It creates a rebuttable presumption that illegal aliens are flight risks and so denies bail so they can't just like go and hide somewhere in America and not show up for their court dates. I mean, all of that is good, right? Like all of that Republicans should be on board with. It's not even like he has an opposition legislature. I mean, we're also not talking about the rhinos that have been in control of the Texas legislature for a while. And, you know, a lot of that kind of conflict that we've seen of historically of Texas Republicans, even though they're technically in control, they appoint Democrats to key positions on committees. And so you basically have rhinos and Democrats working hand in hand. And then they don't really work as well with Governor Abbott. And so you have all of these controversies. Well, Florida shouldn't be like that. Like we have a supermajority and we don't even have a Republican governor and a Democrat legislature, which is in some states, right? Or even like one chamber is controlled by Democrats and the other by Republicans. So you have kind of this opposition and then you have to compromise and some of those other things. Like this is the state that should be getting it together right away, immediately, and saying, while the federal government is now operating on all cylinders, let's get it together and actually pass common sense legislation that deals with everything that is America First policy so that even if Congress doesn't right away on the federal level codify a lot of these executive orders and some of this policy that's now coming from the executive branch, the states can do it, at least the red states. And that, in my opinion, is in some instances even more effective than at the federal level because so much policy comes down to local governance. And so Florida, it should be getting their act together and not having these, you know, kind of internal power struggles or, you know, whatever is the problem with the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, who just maybe didn't want to go back to work in Tallahassee until March. And the special session only lasts for this week. And now they have called their own bill, their own legislative proposal, the Trump Act, which Stephen Miller, who is Trump's main policy guy. He has, you know, some policy title in the White House now. You'll recall him. He's one of the few from the first administration that went into the second. He like reposts this as if, oh, great, it's called the Trump Act. And we all know from DC and from even local politics, it didn't matter what you call something. It matters what it actually is and what it does. And so these rhino Republicans in the Florida legislature call this the Trump Act. But here's the side-by-side that I reposted on my socials. So you can go to my X page as well. But Governor DeSantis and a bunch of other Floridians also posted it. But the Florida legislative leadership's bait and switch is this is what they're actually proposing. And they're calling it the Trump Act just because they think that Trump and to an extent now his team is just going, oh, great, it's called the Trump Act, so let's go for it. So it fails to put an enforceable duty on state and local enforcement to fully cooperate on illegal immigration under the 287G program. This means that Florida localities will provide no meaningful assistance to federal efforts. They're literally trying to give the enforcement of immigration to the agricultural department. Like, And I was talking to my best friend last night about this, and she also lives in Florida. And we were talking about this, and her comment, which I thought was brilliant, she said, you know, if we were looking at the entire scope of, you know, where immigration enforcement should come from, this is like the most random, off-center, completely bogus agency that we could possibly give it to. Like, yeah, let's go give it to agriculture as if that's going to be helpful. That's actually what they're trying to do. And it's because the Secretary of Agriculture, unfortunately, is also a RINO in the state of Florida. It's a statewide elected office as well, not part of the cabinet. So DeSantis can't exactly just, you know, call for resignation or, you know, some of those things, which is probably honestly why the RINOs in the House and the Senate put it in ag, because they want to put it somewhere that they feel is a little bit insulated from the hammer that, you know, that Governor DeSantis is going to bring down on this. But this proposal also unconstitutionally removes authority to enforce the law from the governor to a lower level cabinet agency. So this is talking about the Department of Agriculture, that does not oversee law enforcement and whose stakeholders often oppose enforcement measures. By giving enforcement power to the agricultural arm of state government, it ensures that that enforcement never actually occurs. In short, it puts the fox in charge of the hen house. So, and then you can go down and read, you know, some of the other failures and what it doesn't do. But this is just a stark reminder, I think, that in the midst of President Trump's wins, we have to, as conservatives, be very clear about who is working in tandem with America First policy, with constitutional provisions, with securing our border, with the policy that we all agree on and that conservatives have fought for. I mean, frankly, what Project 2025 has said for all of the boogeyman sort of analysis that the leftist media gave, it's actually in most parts, I mean, I don't agree with 100% of it, but by and large, it's a fantastic proposal that conservatives have been saying for years, for decades. Things like dismantling the Department of Education, things like enforcing the border. So why are some RINOs, even in red states, now opposing the leadership of their own state governors and President Trump? I hope that we don't see this on the federal level as well with some of the either hires, the political appointees, or the nominees from President Trump, because this is exactly what happened in his first term. There was opposition internally to his leadership, and he didn't get as much done because some Republicans just could not get on board. And I am frankly tired of that. We all need to come together as conservatives and say, let's put forward policy and actually get things done while we have the opportunity. The opposition should not be coming from within our own ranks. We expect opposition from the Democrats. We expect opposition from, you know, the wild idiots out there like the Joy Reids and the Rachel Maddows and the, you know, the twisting and manipulation in legacy media, like what we saw in the CBS interview with J.D. Vance, which he handled so well. Like, we expect that. But we should have a reasonable expectation that the people that call themselves Republicans that were elected either on the state level or the federal level, or who were appointed by the state Republican governors or now by President Trump, that they will get on board with the agenda and they will actually advance and do the job that they were hired to do. Right now in the state of Florida, the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, they are not doing the job that the people of Florida hired them to do. And when we look this week at the forthcoming confirmation hearings of RFK Jr., Tulsi Gabbard, Kash Patel, those are fantastic nominees. I don't agree with everything about, you know, RFK. He was 5 minutes ago a Democrat. I've said for a long time the GOP Senate needs to have assurances that he will maintain pro-life policies. But that would require him to get on board with Trump's agenda, because Trump and Vance are very clearly pro-life. So if he wants to be the next HHS secretary, he should immediately say, yeah, absolutely. What the agenda, the 47 agenda is, I'm happy to use my office to advance and further that agenda. That's what Pete Hegseth is doing immediately. I mean, this is like day two, and he's already getting rid of some of the woke DEI in the military. That is fulfilling exactly what Donald Trump hired him to do. Right. And that is exactly what the House and the Senate should get on board with the America First agenda, because they don't. Yeah, they don't work for Governor DeSantis. There's a separation of powers on the state level as well. But they work for us, the citizens of Florida, myself included. And they need to get on board with the mandate of America because overall, they say they're conservatives, they say they're Republicans, they should not be the opposition party. So we should have cohesively red states getting conservative policy done and on the federal level, getting a lot of America First policy done. We should have no opposition from within. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And I love that the federal government is now where woke goes to die. And Trump has now signed executive orders reinstating military members who were fired for refusing to comply with vaccine mandates, complete with back pay. So Fox News reporting that President Donald Trump will sign an executive order to reinstate service members booted from the military for declining to get the COVID-19 vaccine jabs. Quote, the executive order directs the Secretary of Defense to reinstate all members of the military, active and reserved, who were discharged for refusing the COVID vaccine, who request to be reinstated. According to the White House fact sheet, the service members who are reinstated will be restored to their prior rank and will be provided back pay and benefits. You absolutely love to see it. And so our good friend Corey DeAngelis also has a piece in Fox News that Trump's written a DEI government death sentence. School policies should be next. DEI in schools undermine education and support leftist teacher union monopoly. So Corey DeAngelis, who is a senior fellow at the American Culture Project, joins me now. So Corey, you know, I'm loving just getting rid of all of this DEI nonsense. You see the utter meltdown on the left that's now trying to push back and say, but my favorite was that they're calling now Leo Terrell, who's a good friend of mine, by the way. And he was hired by the DOJ. And just because he's a black lawyer, they're now calling him a DEI hire. And I'm like, you guys, you got this all wrong. Like DEI, I mean, it's so embarrassing for them that they are trying to find just anywhere that they can possibly accuse Trump of doing DEI when he's obviously getting rid of it. It's hilarious. But talk about DEI now in terms of school policies and how we need to get rid of all of that.
Yeah, Trump had a great executive order banning DEI in federal agencies. My piece basically argues that we should expand that to schools, too. And some states are actually taking steps to do that. In my home state of Texas, for example, there's been a ban on DEI practices at higher education levels, which raises the question, if it can be banned and it should be banned for adult students in college, why isn't it already banned for younger children at the K through 12 level? And I think it has a lot to do with the idea of power dynamics, where you have special interests who fight really hard to keep the status quo at the K through 12 level, unlike you do at the higher education level. So Governor Abbott just announced recently that he's also fighting to pass a policy this session with a more conservative House than we had last time around after the primaries, and the general election went well too here in Texas, to ban DEI, which I would call divisive educational indoctrination, at the K through 12 level.
Yeah, love that. And you know, and this makes even more sense, as you mentioned, Corey DeAngelis, to get rid of this on the K through 12 level, even more than collegiate institutions, because you know the college level is kind of where you go to debate ideas and at least students are hopefully a little bit more mature and equipped to deal with conflicting ideas. And obviously we don't want teachers to teach this as fact or as, you know, as a good thing. But when you have conflicting ideas and, you know, here's like, for example, a survey of world religions, right? Like even as a Christian, it's okay on the college level to say, you know, here's what different religions think. And you can compare and contrast those ideas. Like that's the point, right? But for K through 12, these types of ideas, they're clearly teaching, teachers are teaching students things as fact, like you can change your gender and all, you know, all the LGBTQ nonsense that just confuses children. So where are we at with some of this on the K through 12 level?
Yeah, look, I mean, this is confusing children at a really young age, and it's really a Marxist ideology that's infiltrated the government-run school system, divides kids based on immutable characteristics like race, and it takes us away from the basics. If you're focusing so much on this stuff, and they even infuse critical race theory into mathematics in schools, and then we wonder why the United States has dropped more than any other country on the latest international assessment, except for three, Iran, Kazakhstan, and one other. We dropped by 18 points in math, and we spend more than just about anybody else in the world, about $20,000 per kid. And there's not a lot of states that are banning diversity, equity, and inclusion at the K-12 level, but I'm glad that Texas, for example, is taking that step, and hopefully they lead the way, because it makes sense. If you're going to ban it for higher ed, let's ban it for K-12 as well. And I'll take it a step further. In Texas, we're also pushing school choice this session, which I think is another important part of the solution, because in Texas and in other states, we've interviewed with undercover journalists at an organization called Accuracy in Media, which I'm a senior advisor with them. They've interviewed DEI administrators in public schools where even if critical race theory is banned, for example, in my home state of Texas, they're still saying that they're going to do it anyway, and they're admitting it on camera, not knowing they're being recorded, and that's been blasted to the public. So if you get a whiff that your child is in a school that is dividing kids, even if they're not breaking the law explicitly, you shouldn't have to go and prove that to a judge to go somewhere else or to have things change. You should fight the system and try to tweak it and make it better, but you should also be able to say, you know what, this is not aligned with my values. My kid's being brainwashed, and they're not going to stay here any longer. I'm going to pull them out and send them to a private school that is aligned with my values, or maybe I want to homeschool. And in Texas, there's a proposal right now in the Senate today, Senate Bill 2, it's their top priority bill this year, to have universal school choice, and it's about $10,000 per kid would follow the child to the school that works best for them. It's everybody, no more picking winners and losers, no discriminating based on your income or background or zip code. And this would be a huge win. They tried to do something similar last year, but the rhinos in the House killed it along with all the Democrats last year. But it might be a blessing in disguise, because we got a new, more conservative House this year in Texas. And following 12 other red states that have already passed universal school choice, the proposal this year is twice as large as the proposal that failed last year. So play stupid games, win stupid prizes. The Democrats have actually provided us with a gift of this year.
That's great. And I'm glad to see Texas doing that and, you know, actually working, you know, hand in hand with their governor, unlike Florida currently. But hopefully that new, more conservative legislature and listeners will recall, especially if you're listening from the state of Texas, that the primaries were just utterly amazing in Texas, got rid of a lot of those rhinos and put in a lot better Republicans for a more conservative legislature. And so if you're in the state of Texas, you're going to want to call your legislators, encourage them to support this bill, banning DEI in K-12 and cutting funding for that. And this is a reminder, Corey DeAngelis, that this type of policy, you know, as much as Trump is implementing this on the federal level, again, like we talked about the first segment, this has to also be done on the state and local level as well. And how important is that distinction? Because obviously it has to be done on the federal level as well. And, you know, we can talk about dismantling the Department of Ed and all of that. But the state and local level is really, I think, where the rubber meets the road in a lot of this.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, especially for K-12 education, federal education dollars, they should account for 0%, but they actually account for about 8 to 9% of total spending. So even if you abolish the federal Department of Education, you could still have a lot of wasteful administrative bloat within the system, especially if they're operating in a monopoly where you don't have school choice. So you have to do both. I mean, you should try to tweak the system, get rid of the federal department. It's unconstitutional. It's a waste of time and money. It was built as a payoff to the teachers union. But you have to fix the system at the state and local level, too. That's where 90% of the funding is. And at the end of the day, if you're still residentially assigned to a school that is failing your student for whatever reason, you still need school choice. So I'd say you have to have top-down reform, but also bottom-up reform by allowing families to vote with their feet. The good news is, Jenna, this week is National School Choice Week, and it's almost like we don't even need a week for this anymore because school choice is winning so much all throughout the year. But we have a lot of states on deck that could go all in on school choice this year, and the ones at the top of my list are Tennessee, Texas, Wyoming, South Dakota, North Dakota, maybe South Carolina as well, but a lot of additional red states set to join the ranks. Just yesterday, Wyoming's House passed universal school choice with no strings attached whatsoever. The Democrats tried to water down the bill as much as they could. All of those amendments failed from the Democrats, which is good news. And they passed the bill 39-20 in the Wyoming House to pass universal school choice. So the momentum is continuing, and it's not going to slow down anytime soon because this is such a popular policy with voters. Democrats and Republicans alike support school choice.
And that's amazing, actually, because you're right that, you know, this shouldn't be a partisan issue. And largely it's becoming one of the few, other than, of course, you know, the teachers unions and some of the Democrats in that kind of lobby are trying to stymie this effort. But all of those states, I mean, we have listeners in all of the states that you just mentioned. And so for everyone listening, wanting to know whether they're in a red or a blue or a purple state, they want to know the status of school choice. And if there's a bill in their legislature, how they can help. Is there kind of an aggregate or a resource that you would recommend, Corey, for how they can look up what's going on in their state?
Yeah, you can look at my X account. Not everybody's on X, but that DeAngelis Corey. I tweet these updates every day. I also forgot New Hampshire has a universal school choice proposal, and also Idaho has one on deck as well. So they're the two states that I forgot earlier. But you can also sign the Students First Pledge, which is at the American Culture Project website. So if you just look up Students First Pledge, you'll find it. And you'll be able to contact your legislators that way and tell them that you want universal school choice. So that's the way to get this done. Politicians respond to power in numbers. That's just the reality. The unions have been really effective at this for a long time. But now we should band together and form a kids' union, have the parents fighting back, and we can win this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I love your definition as well of school choice, because so many people think of that as more, you know, traditionally funded schools. But homeschooling is a big part of that, because you always say, you know, the dollar should follow the student, not the institution. And so for people who are listening to this who are homeschool students or want the opportunity and the ability financially to homeschool their children, how can they best get involved in some of these efforts as well?
Yeah, with homeschooling, there's the gold standard of school choice policy, I would say, is called education savings account. And most policies I've seen on the table this year are education savings accounts. It's not like a voucher where you have to use it only at a brick-and-mortar private school. It's a savings account directed by the parent, rolls over from year to year, and you can use it for any education expenditures, which could include homeschool curriculum or even micro schools where you pay a private tutor and you have basically 5 to 10 children together in a household. A lot of people did this during the COVID era. We were calling them pandemic pods. But this is a way, it's kind of a way to economize on the process of homeschooling where it's not completely one-to-one, but it's a step in that direction. And education savings accounts are the way to go. I will say the proposal in my state this year in Texas is in the form of an education savings account. So it's the way to maximize customization on the part of the parent. And as we all know, schooling is just one way to achieve an education. And in some cases, schooling, especially the factory model that we have in the government-run schools, could actually be the antithesis to education because it stifles innovation.
Yeah, really well said. And I would encourage all of our listeners, follow Corey DeAngelis on X if you have an X account. He does post a lot of great updates there, and you can see what's going on nationally, not just in your state, and also federally. So we've been talking a lot about the states, but in just the last 2 minutes I have with you, Corey, what is your prediction on the Department of Education and, you know, whether we'll see, I mean, I think we'll see a lot of these policies that were bad, you know, kind of being rolled back. But do you think we'll actually get that campaign promise fulfilled of ultimately dismantling the Department of Ed?
I think the more likely thing is that we're going to pass the Educational Choice for Children Act. It's already passed out of the House Ways and Means Committee. Speaker Mike Johnson's on board. Trump said he would sign it, but it's a federal tax credit. You keep more of your own private tax dollars. It wouldn't be federal dollars following the student. And when it comes to the Department of Ed, I mean, look, we have a Republican trifecta this session, and Trump has campaigned on the issue of abolishing that department. We have Linda McMahon selected to be the next education secretary. I hope she body slams that department once and for all. But the reality is we do have a filibuster that could be a problem in the Senate, which requires 60 votes to end. You need more than a simple majority. And there's only 53 Republicans going into this session in 2025. If you don't get, you know, some of the Democrats along, which maybe you can, because there is a bill by Mike Rounds in the Senate from South Dakota, a Republican, to send education back to the states in the form of block grants. You take the existing funding and send that on a per student basis back to the individual states. You'd have more local control that way, and they would determine how to spend that money on education. You'd be able to cut a lot of the bureaucracy and the rot in D.C. You'd be able to fire thousands of administrative bureaucrats at the federal level, and you'd get rid of a lot of those federal strings. Anything that was deemed as necessary, like the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Ed, would move under the Department of Justice. And so that is one way to do it, and I think that's the most feasible way to do it. But I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know if we can get 60 votes to end the filibuster. Perhaps instead of body slamming the department altogether, which is what I would like, maybe Linda will try an attempt of death by a thousand cuts. Maybe there's a ways to minimize the influence of the department. And they did just release a press release after Trump's executive order banning DEI in federal agencies. The Department of Education was one of the first to do a press release saying that they were getting rid of their DEI initiatives and cutting millions of dollars in federal grants. So that's
I'm all for body slamming, and we got to leave it there. Corey DeAngelis, thanks so much. We'll be right back with more to talk more about DEI and getting rid of the woke right after this.
This Sanctity of Life Month, we honor the over 66 million babies whose lives have been tragically ended through abortion since Roe versus Wade. Sadly, with the abortion pill accounting for over 60% of all abortions, babies' lives are at even greater risk now. But in the midst of this darkness, there is a light that shines, and that's Preborn. Preborn's network of clinics have rescued over 300,000 babies from abortion and have prayed with over 80,000 women to come to Christ.
When I heard her heartbeat, I decided to keep her. And now my daughter's about to be 3. I don't know where my life would be without her.
An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. This is Jenna Ellis asking you to join Preborn in protecting life. One ultrasound session costs $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Any gift will help, $100, $200, even $1,000. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we're talking about the federal government now being the place where woke goes to die, and I love it. But, you know, we have to be a little bit cautious as well to ensure, as Corey DeAngelis was mentioning in the last segment, that some of these policies aren't just rebranded or somehow shielded. And we saw the ATF try to just rebrand their chief diversity officer as just a quote unquote senior executive the last week. And of course, that was called out and went viral. And there have been a few other federal government agencies that I'm aware of that have issued emails and guidance to their employees, basically asking and saying, you know, hey, if anyone sees that some of these policies are trying to be shielded, let your managers know, which is great that at least hopefully some of them are trying to follow this type of guidance. There's a great piece in the Daily Wire titled, "Here's How Woke Federal Employees could keep DEI alive in defiance of Trump's order. So employee resource groups in the federal government are often built around DEI activism. So Spencer Lindquist is the author of that piece, and he's a Daily Wire investigative journalist and joins me now. So good morning, Spencer. And, you know, this is a conflict, and it's going to be a conflict within the federal government. And what should we be on the lookout for?
Yeah, good morning, Jetta. This is something that we've seen in the corporate world, the corporate sphere, these affinity groups. They also sometimes go by the more euphemistic term of employee resource groups. And you know, some of these that are rather benign. Sometimes these are groups for new parents. Sometimes these are groups for veterans even. But in most cases, these really seem to be activist nodes that are taking root within not just corporations, but also now within our federal government. So you have Pride ERGs, Pride Employee Resource Groups for LGBT activists. You have BIPOC, or Black, Indigenous, People of Color Employee Resource Groups. And each of these act in these various different departments as ways in which left-wing activism can take place, sometimes in a rather clandestine manner, because this isn't something that is official through the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. This isn't something that is run by specific DEI personnel, but rather it's a voluntary group of agents or bureaucrats within an agency who take it upon themselves to push these left-wing agendas. And this is something that we've seen throughout the federal bureaucracy, and it's certainly an area in which we're going to watch very closely, because this could be the way in which DEI gets smuggled into our agencies, the way in which the ideological takeover of our federal bureaucracy is maintained in spite of Trump's will and in spite of Trump's executive orders.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of these ERGs are almost the equivalent within these corporations or agencies, almost like, you know, campus activist groups, where it's like, you know, they're not actually a class, they're not maybe even sponsored by the university, but they still exist, and they can either, you know, do good things as groups, or they can cause problems for the institution as a whole. And it almost sounds like maybe a similar analogy with these ERGs. And so these employee resource groups, as the acronym stands for. And so, Spencer, what can these institutions do to not allow that kind of infiltration?
One of the things they can do quite simply is to shut down any Pride group, any ERG that is based on an immutable sexual characteristic or a racial characteristic, right? So if these are protected groups, in many cases, people actually aren't allowed to join one if they are from a racial or sexual background that doesn't match the focus of that employee resource group. So that's one way in which people are actually being prevented from joining. And the administration could very clearly just say that this is a form of discrimination. This is a race-based or sex-based group that can't be allowed. And, you know, if they don't, they really could have quite an issue on their hand. I mean, we've seen that some of these groups are extremely radical, and many of them host celebrations and various different events like that. But some have actually helped enforce policies. So they've taken on the stronger role. We've seen this most acutely in the intelligence community, which, of course, is a critical component of our national defense. And in the National Security Agency, we saw a Pride ERG that hosted a training called Privilege Decrypted, and it taught NSA employees about bias, about privilege, and it actually helped implement official DEI policy when it came to pronouns and gender guidance. So we've seen that these have taken a rather active role. And in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, that's a cabinet-level intelligence community group of officials, they actually celebrated Pride by having somebody paint the nails of intelligence agents the colors of the transgender flag. They offered crocheting classes where agents could crochet their own pride flags. And this was all during work hours. And this is a critical component of our national defense. It is really the key to our intelligence community. It oversees the entire intelligence community. They even ran a blog that said, it was called Why I'm an Ally. So these really have acted as nodes of left-wing activism. And you have these DEI offices, which are very formal, and that's what was targeted by Trump's recent executive order. But this is a way in which, if we don't keep an eye on them, if the administration doesn't take action against them, we could see that this agenda could still be pushed forward, even in a more muted fashion.
And I'm speaking with Spencer Lindquist, who's a Daily Wire investigative journalist, and he has a great piece that you should read. Here's how woke federal employees could keep DEI alive in defiance of Trump's order. And you have a quotation in here from activist and reporter Robbie Starbuck. And of course, he's gone viral and he's very known for fighting DEI in corporate America. And he mentions in his quotation what you just said, Spencer, that the federal government must disband these divisive groups who control entry on the basis of race or sexual proclivity preferences. Is there any sort of legal pushback that we know about currently or that maybe potentially is coming for some of these groups saying, well, hey, we have some quote unquote right to exist?
You know, right now, I know that there is.
Yeah, go ahead.
I know that there is certainly an effort within the Trump administration to broaden their approach with DEI, because this first executive order, I believe, was really just that. It was a first step. So I certainly think there will be additional steps to purge DEI, both from the federal government and from academia and corporate America. And something that Starbuck hits on there, which I think is absolutely correct, is that DEI right now is on the ropes. It's in a much more fragile position than it was just 2 or 3 months ago, but it certainly isn't dead. This is an ideology that had effectively taken over our federal bureaucracies. It had taken over academia for years. It had taken over corporate America. So to think that it is something that is simply going to go away quickly, suddenly, within a week of an administration, you know, that of course isn't the case. I think the administration knows that. I think the administration is aware of that. We actually just had another reporter at the Daily Wire, Luke Rosiak, who found that there was a couple of employees from the Biden administration that did what they call burrowing, where they burrow deeper into these executive agencies in hopes that they don't get found out, in hopes that they aren't removed during the changing of administrations. One of those individuals has already been fired from the Trump administration, and I'm very confident that the administration is aware that more attempts like this or attempts to push DEI through these employee resource groups may very well be continuing.
Wow, and that's really good that the Trump administration is taking that swift of action. Again, I think this is where Trump 2.0 is a lot more aware, just collectively, and I think Trump himself, of, you know, some of these bad actors who are infiltrating even his own ranks and personnel. And hopefully we'll see more of that, and we will see not even bad hires to begin with. But Spencer, I also, Lindquist, who's my special guest this morning, I also want to switch gears in the last, you know, 5 or so minutes I have with you to talk about the ongoing situation with the Los Angeles County fires. And I know you've done a lot of reporting on this. So that's still an ongoing story. And there are some reports, of course, that, you know, Trump is now going to force more water to be available in California, some of these things. What can you tell us in terms of what's true about some of these updates and the situation out in L.A.?
Yeah, I was just out there a couple weeks ago and really touring the area around the Pacific Palisades and the areas right along the Pacific Coast Highway. And, you know, that's an area that I knew really well. I went to school on Pacific Coast Highway at Pepperdine University. And it's a heartbreaking scene out there, honestly. It's really difficult to capture the type of devastation. So I know that Trump just visited, and one of the things that he is going to be doing is waiving the federal permitting process for a lot of rebuilding out there, which, of course, is key. You know, everybody knows that California has some pretty extensive permitting processes and a lot of red tape. And that's one of the ways in which I know that he's trying to, that's the policy that he has put forward. And when you go out there, you see some of these houses that you would never expect to really be at risk of a fire. I evacuated from the Woolsey fire in late 2018, and we were considering, should I shelter in place? Should we drive down the coast? And we thought that we'll drive down the coast because if we have to, we can get out of our car and the beach is right there. You know, it's just a few steps away. There's homes there on the beach that look fine, that look fit for a postcard. And right next door, you have one that's entirely burnt down. The only thing that's left is a chimney and the cement studs in the ground. But I know that there's the ongoing effort to rebuild, and it's something we'll be keeping an eye on very closely to see how these residents rebuild and try and bring some life back to these areas. Because when I was there, people were really in shock and trying to figure out what the next step is. And now, of course, that the fires are largely contained, we're trying to figure out how to rebuild.
Yeah, it is just an absolutely tragic situation. And for listeners who recall my representation of Grace Community Church and John MacArthur's church out in Los Angeles as well, I'm aware of at least a dozen families from that church that have lost their homes to the fires. I mean, this is affecting so many people out there, and my heart goes out to them. And Pastor Jack Hibbs was on with me a couple of weeks ago, and his church through Calvary Chapel Chino Hills is organizing, you know, a lot of the donation efforts and some of those things. So you can go to his church if you're looking for a good place that, you know, resources are actually getting there, and donate through his church if you'd like to be involved. But Spencer, you know, with this claim, and I'm reading, you know, just some of the top stories from the legacy media about Trump. This is coming from NBC News, seeks to circumvent laws on California's water amid wildfire response. And then, of course, USA Today, Trump issues new California water order as wildfires continue to burn. What to know about, you know, the truth versus the falsity of this. And so it's like they're already trying to undermine some of Trump's orders. Why does he even have to come in and tell California, the governor and, you know, the mayor of L.A. to just do their jobs?
You know, it's one of the things that when we tried to pinpoint the actual cause of this fire or really how it became so severe, you have to look at this complex web of factors. And of course, you've got the Santa Ana winds, which were 100-mile-per-hour winds that certainly spread the fire. You also have a reservoir in the area right in the middle of the hairs, and it had been left empty for, I believe, nearly a year. So there's a whole host of issues with mismanagement. You also have a DEI focus in the fire department. You've got tensions between the fire chief and the mayor over funding battles. So you've got a number of different issues that seem to have led to an increased severity of these fires. And you've got Trump coming in now. He says that he is declaring an emergency and freeing up access to water. This is something that I think is going to be litigated and relitigated in the public discussion, because the severity of the fire, it is, again, difficult to overstate when you go there and you see the type of damage that was done and the scope of it. California has wildfires. Californians know that these are areas that are prone to wildfires. But to see something as drastic as what just happened, it's unprecedented. And there's going to be a lot of conversation over how it was allowed to get so bad.
Wow. And it will be very interesting, as you mentioned, to see that litigation, to see if we will know the cause of these fires. And obviously there's speculation about whether they were set intentionally or not, or, you know, some of those controversy around it. Litigation's already been filed. And in just the last minute I have with you, Spencer Lindquist from Daily Wire, you can follow him on X as well. We're seeing, I think, a lot of red pilling of Californians who are just so tired of the disaster that is California leadership. Do you think that will carry over into the next election for California, and we might actually see California shifting red a little bit just because of the mismanagement, among other things?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I know that in this case, you've got people who may be leaving California after this, right? It's tough to say if it's going to shift the political balance of California or if it's going to provoke an increased exodus of California. You know, I grew up in California and I left in 2022, shortly after college. And especially during COVID, there was a lot of mismanagement that people saw. And in many cases, it didn't necessarily change their voting patterns, but it changed their residency. They changed their residency. So, you know, it's difficult to tell, but we know that those are two very possible potentialities, either shift in the political awareness or people deciding that the state has simply been run too poorly for them to remain.
Well, we knew that U-Haul was getting a lot out of California and not so much going into California. So, yeah, it'll be very interesting. We'll continue to follow your great reporting at the Daily Wire. Spencer Lindquist, always appreciate you joining. We are already out of time for today, but you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.